We've gone through cash flow pains. We've gone through manpower pains. We've gone through process pains.
Growth is usually messy, uncomfortable, and full of moments where you wonder if you're doing it right.
The best operators in this industry are still making mistakes today.
What makes this conversation different is Steve doesn't pretend they had it all figured out.
We were never content with industry average.
This episode isn't about hacks, shortcuts, or pretending success is easy.
Sometimes you gotta go one step back to go six steps forward.
This is AI and Marketing for Home Service Pros, the show for contractors who want to grow without wasting time or money. If you're in roofing, HVAC, plumbing, or any home service business, we break down how AI and modern marketing can help you book more jobs, close more leads, and build a business that runs without babysitting every task.
Most contractors think growth is supposed to feel clean, confident, and controlled. In reality, growth is usually messy, uncomfortable, and full of moments where you wonder if you're doing it right. My guest today is Steve Van Horn, co-owner and CEO of Simpson Salute Heating and Cooling, a multi-brand home service organization that grew from roughly $3.5 million to nearly $30 million in revenue in just a few years. What makes this conversation different is Steve doesn't pretend they had it all figured out. In this episode, we talk honestly about why growth breaks things before it fixes them, how scaling too fast can actually make your business worse, why struggle, cash flow, stress, and process failures are normal, not signs of failure, the hard decisions behind slowing down on the purpose to grow faster later, how culture, leadership, and training became the real competitive advantage, and why vulnerability and admitting we don't have it all figured out unlocked better people, better systems, and better results. Steve also shares how his background in corporate leadership blended with deep trade expertise and how they built a world-class training facility to solve labor issues most contractors can't, and how they position the business to partner with a top-tier platform without exiting or losing control of their culture. This episode isn't about hacks, shortcuts, or pretending success is easy. It's about building a durable business, learning through mistakes, and understanding that progress, not perfection, is what actually creates long-term success. If you're a contractor who's growing, struggling, or questioning whether the chaos you're experiencing is normal, this conversation will hit home. Let's get into it. What's up, everyone? This is Mauricio Cardinal. Today, I'm with Steve Van Horn from Simpson Hair and Cooling. Welcome to the show, Steven.
Thanks, Mauricio. Good to be with you.
Super excited to talk to you. We had a great conversation last week, and I really want to get into your story and really your success with in this industry, because I think people can learn a lot from what you guys have accomplished so far.
Yeah, hopefully we can help people learn from our mistakes the same way we've learned some things from others.
Yeah. You know, you said your business is an ongoing evolution, right? Not something that you ever finish. Why do you think that mindset matters so much in this industry?
There's a number of reasons why I think it matters. One, the industry's an evolution and customers are an evolution. So if you become content with like, hey, we're doing things exactly the way they need to be done and that's it, we're done, it's a completed product now, then I think you're gonna quickly fall behind because again, the industry's constantly changing, customer expectations, economic factors, like there's just so many things at play that you have to constantly be evolving. If you look at where the trades was, you know, 20 years ago to now, it's night and day difference. If you look at where it was even 5 years ago when I first came into the industry to where it is now, it's vastly different. And if you look at, you know, even in the last 12 months, like this little thing called AI that we used to never talk about in our industry, right? Like we're almost like AI immune here, where people always said like, AI is never gonna go in the basements and fix furnaces or in the attics and fix air conditioners, right? Like AI will never penetrate our industry. Like it's here to stay, and it's absolutely influencing our industry. While it can't, you know, physically repair it, it can pretty much do everything leading up to that technician having his tools in his hand and everything thereafter. So I think if you approach your business that way, it also makes you as an owner and an operator less inclined to be satisfied ever. It makes you every day wake up hungry to find out what the next changes are and the ways that you can kind of manipulate your business so that you can hit the goals. And when I say manipulate, I mean it in a very positive way, not in a negative way that sometimes people use that word manipulation, but the different levers within your business that you can pull to make sure that you're adapting and staying on cue. Workforce changes, expectations of today's worker versus expectations of workers 30 years ago, that's changed. We're constantly having to evolve to that. So all that, Mauricio, just kind of compiles to this evolutionary mentality that Chad and I have had, where we want to be on the forefront. We don't want to ever be the laggards that are, you know, slacking and dragging into this new stuff. We want to be the ones out on the forefront, kind of blazing the trail. So it just makes us very hungry. But I think if you do adapt this mentality of like, hey, once I get there, I'm done, then you become less willing to adapt and to use some of those new technology and things that can really enhance your business in a positive way. So very long answer. I'll try to shorten those up for you. Yeah. But that's the way I feel about the evolutionary question.
Yeah, that's fine. That's great that you said that. A lot of contractors feel discouraged when, you know, growth gets messy. Why do you think struggle is normal, not a necessary part of scaling?
Yeah, and I would just tell anyone who's listening that maybe is in that spot, like I've been in that spot. Chad and I have been in that spot together. By the way, Chad's my business partner. We've grown from, you know, $3.5 million to $27 million in revenue in 5 years working together in the trades industry. Chad's been at it for almost 25 years. And I think, you know, there's this pride thing in the trades, I would call it. And like any person has pride, right? Where sometimes we're not willing to be vulnerable and admit that, like, hey, our business isn't perfect and it's not as good as I want and need it to be. And we've gone through those pains over the last few years while we've been very successful in growing the business. Like, we've gone through cash flow pains, we've gone through manpower pains, we've gone through process pains, like you name it, we've been there, we've done that. And I know what it feels like to be in those contractor seats where you go to Service Titan Pantheon or you go to a big trades event or ACCA or whatever, or sit in a room at your local distributor's trainings and you hear people fist pumping and pounding their chest about all the success they're having and how they're hitting these crazy margins and my EBITDA is blah, blah, blah. And then it's funny because, you know, now I have an opportunity to sit here 5 years later and like some guys who were pounding their own chest about how great their EBITDA was 3 years ago that made me feel very insecure about where ours was, and I thought it was decent at the time, are now the guys who I sit down with and they're like, dude, can I be honest with you? Like, you get them in a one-on-one situation. I'm like, yeah, what's up? They're like, I didn't even know what EBITDA was when I said that 3 years ago, right? Like, I'd heard it, but I didn't understand my P&L. I definitely didn't know how to navigate my P&L and how to influence it. And I'm like, and I've encouraged contractors over the last few years to say, like, you know, why didn't you say that? Like, it was okay to say that at the time. Like, I know it was important. I myself am trying to wrap my head around it. And, you know, my feeling on that is, Mauricio, like, I have so much more respect for those people that are vulnerable and just honest. Like, we're all in this trying to figure it out together, right? So instead of promoting this thing you have figured out only in a year to lose your credibility by admitting you didn't have it figured out, only to proclaim you now have it figured out again, to in a year say, whoop, I was wrong again. Like, you do that so many times, it's like the boy who cried wolf, right? Like, at some point you just need to say, like, I don't have it figured out. And we're very good at that organizationally. We define ourselves by this why mentality, why we do everything that we do. It's to serve our customers and our coworkers. And when you start saying that to people, it changes everything. And I would just recommend that to any contractor, not to be insecure with where you're at, but just to be vulnerable and honest. And when you are that way, the answers just start flowing. People feel very comfortable helping you and giving you things that they've learned because they feel like they're not sharing their wisdom with someone who already has everything figured out. And inevitably, we call it shares gain, right? That's what Chad and I have dubbed it. I don't know if that's something we invented or something we borrow from somebody else, but shares gain is whenever you share something that maybe you are a little better than most at with someone, they're inclined to share some other things with you. So the more, again, we're vulnerable with each other and don't let those insecurities of like, I'm not doing everything perfect today, get in the way of just being honest with people, then I think you'll find out that your business can really move forward in some positive ways that it's impossible to when you're putting this protective bubble around yourself and trying to puffer yourself in front of the industry as if you're perfect. The best operators in this industry are still making mistakes today. They'll still look back in 2 years and wish that they knew today what they know in 2 years. It's just the way that the world works. Me as a parent, I have three boys, Mauricio. Like, I wish I would have known when I raised my 15-year-old what I now know in raising my youngest 9-year-old. I'm a better parent now to my 9-year-old, but there's no substitution for doing things the wrong way and going through the pains and struggles of self-reflection and looking back with some regrets, but committing that, hey, going forward, I'm going to do it better. But if you're not willing to admit you ever made mistakes or you didn't have it all figured out, then it becomes hard to self-diagnose, self-reflect, and make improvements, right?
Yeah, I read this book called from Keith Cunningham. I don't know if you heard about it. It's called, I forgot what the name. The author is Keith Cunningham. He says like a very good thing. He says basically business is an intellectual sport. And even though there's trades, people think it's not complicated. It is complicated. Business is always going to be complicated. It's something that you have to learn. There's nobody that teaches you these things, right? I'll give you my example. Like, I've been doing this for 9 years and it took me 9 years to figure out the actual business model that we're in. And what I mean by that is that instead of looking at us more of a, as a service-based
marketing agency. We're really more of like an enterprise software kind of company. We don't sell enterprise software, but that's kind of the same business model. And that's kind of took me 9 years to realize that. So that's kind of the evolution. Everybody's still learning, still growing, and you have to understand that as a business owner, right? So there's things that you do that. And you, yourself, you're going to be lessons from right now 27 million to, if you want to get to 100 million, I'm sure there's going to be different lessons there.
And I'm sure, you know, looking back to my earlier point, like you probably wish you knew now what you knew then, maybe even 5 years ago, if you had better defined who you were, like it probably would have changed the messaging you delivered to your clients. And but now you make a choice, you know, do you admit that, hey, I didn't have it always figured out so that you can make progress moving forward? Or do you just keep your pride intact and say like, I was right then, but now I'm even more right. You know, like there's nothing wrong with sometimes saying you're wrong. We have to say it on a pretty regular basis. We pride ourselves in being a pretty progressive company. With that comes mistakes. We always use the analogy that we're building the airplane in the sky, right? But also with the absolute industry best practices in mind. So we never want our customers and our coworkers to feel the pain of us assembling that airplane in the sky. So when we roll out new processes, procedures, whatever it is to our entire team, we always say like, hey, here's why we're doing it. Because you have to communicate the why. We've always been good at the what and the how. Those are two really big things you have to be able to describe. But if you really want people's buy-in, the why is really important. Because there's a reason why you're doing what you're doing. It's not just to create more work or to create more micromanagement. It's to, again, back to our core value, to always serve the customer better and our coworkers better. So when you describe the why this new thing is going to support that mission, then you find out that people will usually get behind it. And then if you do make a mistake and it wasn't the right way to do it, it buys you some grace. We use this G word often in our business that like, hey, I know it didn't work out, but you all understood why we wanted to do it, right? And most of the time people are like, yeah, absolutely, to better serve our customers and our coworkers. So it made sense. We tried it, wasn't successful, and we're always willing to pivot quickly. But you know what I'm talking about, Mauricio. You see these contractors on a regular basis. Like oftentimes they're very prideful, I think is the word, and they're not willing to admit that, hey, what I'm rolling out today might not work. Hey, it might not be the right answer. Hey, I might not have been right last time I tried this. And if I am wrong, then I'll pivot. Like sometimes they're trying to force that square peg into a round hole for way too long. And this industry just moves so fast that, that's just wasted time. If you try it and it doesn't work, you have to be willing to pivot quickly, take a little bit of a pride hit and say, thanks team, I appreciate your support in trying to make that work. I think we gave it our best effort. And now we're gonna pivot because it wasn't as successful as I thought it should have been. So, and then the other thing we're big on is asking input from our teams. Like, hey, here's the idea, here's the initial concept, help me define it, help me bring some substance to this process or to this thing, right? And then when it doesn't work, we're big at pulling our teams in. Now we created these different groups within our organization where we have input from different levels within the organization, from leaders to, you know, we might have an installer on a panel where we can get their feedback. And when things don't work, you know, we immediately go to those committees and we say, why did it fail? Was it execution? Was it just a bad idea? Was it a lack of software that we maybe could have better supported it with, or a lack of process? Do we try it again and just rewrite the process now with some better things in place? Or do we just scrap it all together and say, nice try, but it's just not worth the time and effort at this point? But all those things are critical into growing a successful organization.
You got the lesson from Simon Sinek, Start With Why, right?
I did. I first read that book probably, I think it was shortly after it came out, like I want to say 8-10 years ago. And it was definitely pivotal then. And it fell in that classification of like something that worked so well that I forgot about it. So coming into the trades, I kind of didn't remember that book as well, even though it was a pretty big part of my past career at Xerox Corporation, like this why mentality. And I found it helped me to adapt to this younger generation of coworker even better when I could start with the why, because they really need that more than like the baby boomer. When you hire baby boomers, you just tell them what to do and they're going to do it. Like it's the way they were raised. Like they're bootstraps type people. Like they might go home and kick the dog and yell at their wife about it, but they're still going to show up and work their tail off, right? Because that's what they do. But this younger generation, they really need the why. They'll take why over vacation time, pay raises. They want to feel like they're part of something. And the reality is, like as a business who's trying to be on the forefront, like we need them to be part of it. I need your ideas. I'm 41 years old now. I still think I'm young and cool, but I'm not. My kids remind me of it all the time. So when you pick the brains of these younger generations, that you'll find out that they're creative, right? They're very aware of trends that are going on in the industry. They're very technology driven, very technology engaged. So they're bringing me tools like, you know, I think of Drex, who's one of he's always been referred to as my Padawan. I hired him at Xerox when he was 19 years old. Great young man. He was working on an assembly line, actually, and I gave him a life-changing opportunity at Xerox Corporation. He rose the ranks pretty quickly and kind of filled in my footsteps there. I left. 2 years later, he came and joined us here in the trades, and he's killing it here. But again, he's 28 years old now, so we've been working together for almost 9 years. He would take a bullet for me, and he knows I would do the same for him. But as soon as he came into the industry, he started looking for tools, and he found things like Conduit for load calculation. Like, that's not something that was really on my radar. I thought I had found something that was already better than the old manual J. But he found something even better, leveraging technology. And then he found Mantle through a relationship with Zach and Kevin over there. And that's been a game changer for us in the way that we've elevated our tickets and our customer close rate and our customer reviews. And so it's just so unique. But, you know, I think, again, back to my earlier point, Mauricio, like a lot of times tradesmen look at it like, I got this figured out. I don't need this young whippersnapper to come in here and tell me about this technology and how we change it. Like, do the damn manual J the way we've always done it, because it works, right? Like, yeah, it does work, and it takes an hour to do it accurately, right? Like, we can now focus more on that relationship process with the customer and do the manual J just as accurately in a matter of minutes, right? So those are the kind of things that, you know, you have to lean on these generations. Now, what I pride ourselves in here in our organization, I think we're close to like 30 or 40% female staff. So we get some great insights, some great diversification. We have multiple minorities employed here. We have some 17-year-olds, and we have some 65-year-olds. Like, so when we can use that again to form these teams, we call them our committees, we end up with some really unique insights. Like, we've built that out so that we get to see things from all angles. And I think that makes us dangerous, because a lot of times it's, and I hate to say it this way, but it is what it is. Like, a lot of times there's like 5-60-year-old white men in the room trying to decide what's the best for an organization in their community. And the reality is, like, they don't always have the best perspective on things, right? Sometimes you need that young person to tell you what you're missing. You need that female voice to say, like, hey, aren't females a huge part of this buying process? Have we looked at it from this angle? I think this might be important to them. And when you're willing to listen as an owner, which Chad and I very much always have been, they're usually so invested because they know, like, they're heard, they're listened to, their feedback's accepted. And then when they see, like, that adopted into a standard operating process or procedure, like, what do you think that does as far as employee retention? Like, when you can show them that I value you, I hear you, you're a big part of this, and I'm going to use your feedback to make us better organizationally. And then you sit in a meeting and you give them credit for that. Or at we have a quarterly breakfast every month with every employee where we do like a shout out thing. And it just makes the organization, it elevates us all again, because it's a feeling that you notice we don't call anyone an employee. It's been a huge thing. Like, I started that, I don't know, probably a decade ago at Xerox. Like, we have no employees here. We're all coworkers. We all have different jobs. Some might be higher up in the organizational flow chart than others. So it's not like this, like, symbiotic, like, we all sit in a huddle and sing, you know, kumbaya together mentality. That's not it. Like, you still see we have office chairs, not beanbag chairs. Like, we're here to work. But we also value every single person's opinion, and every coworker is equally as important. So we started this, you know, mentality where everyone in our organization now calls them coworkers for a reason. Because no matter what wage you're at, no matter what your age is, your role in this company is equally as important to serving our customer and each other. And if you can adapt that in business, then I think you'll find out you create a culture, which we don't get to decide what our culture is, right? That's up to our people to decide, and our customers decide what kind of culture we have. I can't, as an owner, just proclaim on top of the mountain that I have a great culture, and this is what it is. A culture is like a living, breathing thing, right? Like, you have to... You can walk through my offices and ask people what kind of culture they have. But if you ask me right now, Mauricio, how's your culture? I'd say, like, I think it's great, but you're going to have to go ask 104 other people how it is, because I'm the owner. I don't know. I don't know what's said in the coffee room when I walk out, right? I don't know what they're saying after the company Christmas party. I think I know, but again, I kind of get a skewed perspective of that. So, but I think that's a neat thing that I get to sit back and witness many times, is the culture that we do have. And I feel pretty strongly that I do know what most people are going to say. And they're going to say, like, I feel valued here, and I feel organizationally we're driving the industry, not sitting back just waiting to adapt to what other companies are doing well. With that said, we also R&D, you know, the old Robin duplicate in the HVAC industry. Plenty of other ideas. If we see someone else executing something well, then we're like, let's do that. It seems to work really well for them.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are a lot of things that you talked about. Was obviously the culture aspect, which is a huge part of building a great company. I think Peter Drucker said once that culture eats strategy for breakfast any day of the week. And it's important. I mean, people have asked that for a long time, but it's kind of something that people struggle, a lot of companies struggle with. the broad question, how did you build that culture for your business?
Exactly the way I just said. We diversified our staff. We recruit talent now. We don't just hire through Indeed. Every interaction I have with someone in the community, whether it's a server at a restaurant, a barista at a coffee or at a coffee shop, I go to upgrade my cell phone. I've hired cell phone guys because I see their commitment to customer service working for a large organization, their ability to execute process with a smile on their face and make that customer a priority. Like every day, our leadership team especially is looking for those interactions so that we can develop what we call our bullpen, right? When all of a sudden there's a need, we don't want to have to go to Indeed and filter through 150 bad applicants, right? We want to say, like, we already know who this person's about because they interviewed without even knowing they were interviewing, and then we go and we get them. Like, I'll usually make the initial pitch where I'm calling and saying, like, hey, crazy thought. Like, is this something you've always wanted to do the rest of your life in your current industry? Or have you ever been open-minded to doing something different is usually how that conversation goes. But facilitating those teams that we call committees has been important for us, for people to feel, again, valued and heard and like they're part of something. We need that. We want that organizationally for them and for the organization. So I think all those things contribute to culture. I mentioned the quarterly breakfast. We have monthly meetings. We have weekly meetings. So like our sales team's meeting every Monday morning. Our service team's meeting every Thursday morning together organizationally. Our installers on Wednesdays. Our finance team has regular scheduled meetings. And the meetings are usually very upbeat and positive. They're very action driven and oriented. We don't just sit in a room and bore each other. Kind of that Elon Musk mentality that, like, if there's no value in that meeting, then don't waste your time being there. There's other things to do. So I think that drives culture. We hang every job description in our companies hanging on this wall outside here on clipboards. We update them regularly and we refresh them and put the date up there. So you can see any personnel in this company, any of our coworkers' job descriptions are published out there. So you can see exactly what that is, which creates extreme accountability, I think. We're constantly doing different, awards and giveaways. We have a President's Club trip, which is really unique in the HVAC trades. We started that 5 years ago when I came on board and Chad was all about it. So all of our revenue driving coworkers have quotas. So their President's Club criteria is tied to that quota, whatever it is, and there's kickers. So for a technician, that involves like a certain amount of options that have to be provided on every single call, deploying the probes a certain percentage of times, a certain revenue that includes like kickers such as indoor air quality and things like that. So things that, again, are helping us to serve the customer better by reinforcing through quoted items on their compensation plans. But when they hit a certain level, they qualify for President's Club trip, which means they now get to go on an all-inclusive vacation. We go together as a team. For 1 week, it's usually somewhere tropical, right? Jamaica, Dominican, Mexico, wherever. All-inclusive resort for them and their significant other. And when we added that, it was so cool. We've just continued to expand it. This year, we added a legacy award where the criteria is you have to have been here for at least 10 years. You get nominated through your peers. We have a committee that meets and reviews those nominations and selects each year's winner. So I think the first year we did it, we took like 7 people and their spouses or significant others. And then the next year we expanded the criteria out to a few additional departments and we were able to take, I think, 12. This year we're taking 29 coworkers and their significant others. And it's become like a buzz throughout the organization where people are like, I went in, how do I get in? And if there isn't a criteria, which I think at this point, every single person has a criteria to make President's Club trip. But for the last few years, it was like, you're right. Every person should be eligible for this. We just got to figure out what that carrot is, to dangle in front that motivates you to drive it. But I know that's a big part of our culture, Mauricio. Just the fact that when you walk in the office, like we try to engage every person, fist bumping and just having a conversation with them and trying to get to know them on a more personal level. It can't always be about work, right? You can't always walk into the office and say like, how's the dispatch board look today? How many calls do we have? What's our capacity? What's our need? How many calls are we going to outbound today? Like if that's all you're ever talking about, then you're going to have real issues in like breaking through that culture wall, right? Because your culture becomes, it's all about metrics and metrics management is not going to drive culture. It has to be there. It has to be present. But to your earlier point that like, process war, or what was it? How'd you word it? Process, culture eats process for breakfast.
No, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yeah. So and I agree with that. I think the reality is like you have to have both. Like without culture, it becomes really hard to drive strategy and process. But you can do it. It just becomes much harder. I think what happens is that organizationally you see more turnover, you see more coworker dissatisfaction, right? People just don't enjoy their jobs as much. There's probably just a lack of joy around the office. I've been to those offices. Those people can still execute at a high level. I think it's a more stressful environment to operate in as an owner operator, because there's just like this constant paranoia or like chip on your shoulder throughout the office. And I don't think we have that. Now, I already said we're not perfect, right? Like, people have bad days. You find the right person today, they're going to have something that they need to vent about, and that's okay. Organizationally, we are imperfect, and we know that. Our goal is not perfection. It's progress, daily progress. So, but when you accept that and you allow people to be imperfect, and I already mentioned the G word a couple times, you're a company of grace. We feel like our culture is, we empower everyone here. A technician can make some pretty extreme calls in the field. Our CSRs can make some pretty extreme calls on the phones. Like, you are empowered because we're a company of grace. We drive everything through our core values, right? And we ask the simple question, when someone makes a decision that maybe wasn't the way we wanted it done, we'll say, did they make a decision that was in the interest of better serving our customers or our coworkers? And if the answer is yes, then it becomes a coaching opportunity. It's not a fireable moment. We'll say, like, you know what? You did it in the spirit of the customer's best interest. So great decision. The customer is now taken care of. Next time, here's some other things you might want to consider that might leave the company in a better position or you as the coworker in the better position. But we try to never crucify anyone and say, like, you made the wrong call. That's terrible. Look what you cost this company. Because we know that those are the pains of growing and empowering your culture is, you're empowering your workforce, is that you're going to sometimes make the wrong call. And when you do, as long as it's based on the right mentality, then we'll deal with it. We'll coach through it and we'll move on and we'll allow you to make those mistakes, right? But you have to be a company of grace. You have to be a company of empowerment. And you have to have a core value, because if you don't, then what do you tie all that back to, right? Like, well, why'd you make that decision? Well, I thought it was best. Best based on what, right? That becomes the question. Best based on my own personal experiences, my own personal philosophies. You can't leave that subjective. Of all the things you can leave subjective, you can't make that subjective. That needs to be a fixed thing. It needs to be static. Everything we do is to better serve our customers and our coworkers. And when we do that, you notice, like, we don't talk about the company much, because we know when we do those two things, the company almost always wins. Almost always. This is not a sprint. It's a marathon. We might lose today, but we will win the marathon at the end of the day if we allow those to be our guiding values, right?
Yeah, yeah. Last time we talked about this, you grew quickly from 3.5 million to 7 million very quickly. What broke first when that growth hit?
A lot of stuff broke first. Cash flow broke quickly because the bills got bigger and payroll got bigger and vendors wanted their money fast and we were spending money like it was on fire on marketing and rapid vehicles. So that broke. Communication breakdowns because we didn't always have the SOPs that we have now to support that growth. So we became aware of our poor communication skills sometimes, like thinking that everyone knew, but realizing I never told everyone what was on my mind, or I never communicated the why again. So we saw a slight increase, although still way below industry averages. We saw an increase in callbacks and customer dissatisfaction. So year two was really, again, going from that 3.5 to, you know, 7, we'll call it, in year one of Chad and I being partnered together. It was definitely a time to reflect on, like, things we could do better and how it wasn't just about top line growth. Chad had spent 20 years building a really strong foundation under this house. We were like building the first level, and now all of a sudden, like, we were realizing, like, we weren't installing the flooring the right way and the siding the right way. So even though, again, everything we were doing was still way above industry average, you know, our callbacks were way under what the industry was averaging, but we were never content with industry averages. We had our own targets that were virtually, we wanted almost no callbacks, right? Like, unless it was a manufactured defect, we knew that we could try to mitigate that. And we, you know, our vendors are giving us awards for our low callback rates. In the meantime, we're in huddles panicking, like, this is crazy. We just don't do this. We expect, again, in the interest of best serving the customer, that we should not have these rates. So we had to sit down and come up with some processes. We built out a 5,000 square foot training facility in Canton area that's kind of centered to our companies. Developed a relationship with the state of Ohio, where we're now administering continuing education credits, tech cred programs in the state of Ohio that we get reimbursed through the state for. Lieutenant Governor John Husted last year came and spent an entire day at our training facility, which was a huge moment, not just for us and the trades, but also for I think the entire industry. Like, that kind of traveled like fire. Like, a lieutenant governor of Ohio is spending a day slumping with these trades dudes. Like, that's just kind of crazy, right? So that was neat. We created a partnership with Walsh University. As far as I know, it's the first collegiate affiliation with any HVAC company in a major university in the country. So that was cool a few years ago, where we now, again, in the interest of, like, getting the best advice and angles that you possibly can, right? That you have access to. Like, we're now talking to like college educated people, which, you know, I went to college, I have multiple degrees, but I'll tell you, like, I haven't been back in a college in 20 years, and a lot of things have changed. So now, like, having access to some of the resources where they get this fresh perspective of our businesses and the way we administer our trainings and stuff like that, like, being open to that feedback. We tell them when they come in, like, please, if you see something that stands out, tell us. And they were, they would. We made it so that they were comfortable giving us that feedback, and we were able to adapt things and make them even better with this outside perspective from people who weren't even in our industry, right? So all those things just continue to like kind of move us forward. But we made a conscious decision, Mauricio, from year 2 to 3, we weren't going to focus on just top line growth, or year 1 to 2, I'm sorry, that we were going to focus more on these other things. So we slowed down. We went from, you know, 3.5 to 7 million in year, we'll call it 0 to 1. And then year 1 to 2, we went from like 7 to 10. So it was significantly less growth. So it was still growth. And then what happened as a result of that was we exploded in year 3. So from year 2 to 3, we grew to 18 million, I think it was. And then year 3 to 4 was kind of, again, like, let's pump the brakes a little, not quite as much as we did year 1 to 2. But let's get back to, you know, making sure that we organizationally are really primed for that next level of growth. And I think we went up to, you know, like 21, 22. Last year finished at 20, I think it was close to 27 million. Haven't completely closed the books out on 2025 just yet. But, and then we have a very ambitious growth program this year where we're, so you've noticed this trend of like fast growth, slow it down a little bit, fast growth, slow it down a little bit, fast growth, slow it down. And we do that intentionally. Like, you see so many companies that become a house of cards, like they're building their foundations on quicksand. And we don't want that. You know, we're an organization that's existed, like, two of our brands have been in business for almost 100 years. We've been doing this for almost 25 now, you know, when you count the company Chad started, and he's been here the whole time. So we're trying to build something extremely stable, but also something really exciting that can grow fast. So that's the reason why we kind of go gas, brake, gas, brake. This year's a gas year. We're hoping to grow from 27 to about 34 million. And we have a pretty good plan of how we're going to do it. We don't operate on hope. We operate on strategy. Strategy, culture, and process is what we do every day. That's what we live and breathe. So I think we'll hit it. We haven't come up short of a goal yet. We always have a goal and a stretch goal. And so far, every single year, we've hit our stretch goal. And I think this will be another year where we're able to do that through some of these things.
Awesome, awesome. At what point did you realize that more leads can actually make things worse instead of better?
Well, that's a great question. And kudos to you for asking that question, because when times get tough for a company, one of the first things they want to do is, and they don't realize they're doing it, is they compound the issue by saying, like, how do we get more leads? How do we get more leads? We need to discount more. We need more business, right? And really, if your processes are broken, that's the last thing you want to do, because all you're doing now is paying more to lose more, right? So, and again, that ties back in, Mauricio, with our strategy of like grow and then recalibrate, grow and recalibrate. So flashing forward to one of those years where we recalibrated, I want to say it was 22 to 23, we were looking at like booking rates. And, you know, we're pouring money into the marketing machine. We've figured some things out. And, you know, again, I mentioned earlier, like, I wish I knew in 23 what I knew, what I didn't know in 21, or vice versa. I wish I knew in 21 what I knew in 23. But some things that I also was not keeping my eye on was like our booking rates were slipping down. So we were moving so much faster. Our CSR were rushing calls, not intentionally. They're great people. They wanted to do a good job, but they felt rushed and we weren't giving them good direction. They didn't have focus because we didn't have a CSR manager at that time. So we look at our call rate and we're like freaking out, like 43% booking rate, like, this can't be right. So we engaged Brigham Dickinson at Power Selling Pros, and they came in and worked with GoTime Success Group. We were consulting with them for some service type workflows. We found out, luckily, it wasn't that bad, that we were misclassifying a lot of calls and we weren't booking things correctly, but still we were in like the 60s. And we just organizationally felt as though we could do so much better. We had these super talented CSRs who wanted to do a great job, but we weren't giving them the best tools to be able to succeed. So started working with Brigham and his team on a regular basis to better train our CSRs. And Chad and I participated in those CSRs meetings and trainings so we could help reinforce it, set in the bullpen multiple times so that we could actually answer the phone and test ourselves to see how well we could do it. And what we saw is we were able to get that booking rate just through better talk tracks and better understanding, expressing empathy, eliminating negative words, being really diligent on the phones, that we were able to get our booking rate up into the mid-90s. So we almost eliminated our booking, non-booking rate altogether, which is fantastic. So But again, you know, the day you take your eye off that, the day it starts slipping backwards. So now we have to come up with a process that can continue the ongoing support. So we hired a CSR manager. We scheduled ongoing trainings with Power Selling Pros where they're working with our CSRs. They do a group call every week. They do individual training sessions every week. They're communicating with our on-site manager to make sure they're all getting consistent, what we call quarterly business reviews, QBRs, where they're looking at incoming rates, outgoing rates. We're having conversations with CSRs about other things they might want to do within the organization that bring value. So just, again, like, I wish in 2021 we were that good, but we weren't. And I'm sure in 2027 we're going to look back and be like, man, I wish we were as good in 2025 as we are now. But I'm glad we are where we are now. And those are the things, Mauricio, that I think have been huge game changers for us. And again, it takes sometimes like a little bit of slowing down. You've heard that phrase, you know, sometimes you got to go one step back to go six steps forward, right? And I think we've always been very willing to do that.
Yeah, so. I think there's a lot of disconnect between, a lot of mistrust, honestly, with a lot of marketing agencies and contractors. A lot of marketing agencies overpromise and underdeliver, and I'm sure you probably experienced that yourself. But if you have all the stuff you just said yourself, like fixed, right, and you have it corrected, and you can actually maximize the results with all the leads that are coming in, and you understand the strategy behind the actual marketing, then you're setting up yourself for success.
That was, I don't know if you know Brigham Dickinson's story, but that was
him. He was in the podcast. Yeah, he was in the podcast.
Okay, awesome. So for those that haven't maybe heard it, like he had a marketing agency where he was producing leads, and the guy came to him and basically said, like, the leads are crap. And so he went back and started listening to some of the opportunities and said, like, these leads are good leads. Your people just don't know how to book them. Like, what if it was like a tack-on service for his marketing agency then. Like, what if I could better coach your people to be able to handle these leads? And that's how Power Selling Pros kind of began, was like, maybe my passion is more helping people to you know, be able to capitalize on their talents versus trying to own a marketing agency. So he said, like, I'm going to let the marketing agencies focus on that. My passion is now the people. And again, like, taking that one step further, like, we had to really dig deep into like our technicians processes. Once you figure out how to get your booking rates as high as possible, great. Now I'm getting techs in the home, but now I have to focus on the way that they're communicating. You know, our whole process is defined around this uncovery, education, and options, right? That's what we want our technicians to do. Like, we want to use the best tools available. We deploy MeasureQuick probes. We leverage technology, TC TrueFlow AirGrid, to test for static pressure. You know, the best Sauerman's combustion analyzer on the market. Like, we want the best tools, the best data, so we take the opinions out of it so we can present homeowners with facts, right? And then we're going to build out options on ways we can either enhance or improve your system. And then you just educate them, and then you sit back and say, like, what you know, what do you want to do? And if they say, like, well, I'd like to do this, but I don't have enough money, like, great, we have some financing options. Let me build that out for you, right? But we pride ourselves in not being overly high pressure. I think sometimes our ability to communicate really well can be perceived as high pressure, but we try to keep that reined in as well. Like, we really just want to do a great job for homeowners. But if your technicians aren't able to communicate well, and they don't have good tools and ways of collecting data, then you're going to see your no matter how many leads you're paying for, Mauricio, you're still going to suffer with back end results. And if you're just going to pay a fortune to get techs in homes and then produce low tickets, it's not a good formula for success. So you'll know better than me, Mauricio, like, what's the average cost of customer acquisition right now? Not market a lead, like, what's your average cost to win a customer, all things in at this point?
Really depends on the trade, right? Depends on the channel you're using, right? Depends on the service area, depends on the location.
So let's say average for HVAC across the, let's call it like a modest suburban market like ours, like Ohio, you know, whatever, West Virginia.
Yeah. So what I like to do is basically, it's more of like a set of average, I would say a range, right? So whatever a range is acceptable to you, right, then that makes sense for you, and that you can actually scale for that. So it depends on what your numbers look first, and then you can accept the range. So depending on the service area, it could be anywhere from, you know, $200 to $500, sometimes $500 to $1,000, right? So it just depends on that.
That's the exact number I've heard, funny enough. I've always heard $400 in our market is the cost to get that customer to call you. But then you're looking at closer to $2,000 to actually acquire that customer. Meaning, like, that's your cost of your first service call where you need to communicate really, really well to call them a customer. After the first call, they're just a Google lead or a Facebook lead. Like, at that point, it's just a lead. They're not your customer yet. They're not your customer until you've acquired them, until you've shown them what differentiates you from the competition, right? And at that point, when they no longer are going to Google and typing in heating repair near me, and they're going there and typing in Simpson Salute Heating and Air, Now that's your customer. You've now acquired that customer, but it requires a really good process from the way you answer the phone, to the way you dispatch your technicians, to the way you communicate up until you get to the home, the way you get into the home, the way you communicate after you leave the home, right? Like, it's all a thing that strings together that drives down your marketing cost at the end of the day. Because again, if you're just constantly having to pay $400 to make the phone ring, $400, but you can't retain that customer because you don't have the processes on the back end to support them, it's going to be a really expensive way of operating your business. It can be done, but you want to make sure you're really sharp somewhere else, because you're going to have to make up, you know, millions of dollars over the course of several years to be able to justify why you're not investing in your people and your processes, and you're just investing on more money to make the phones ring.
You're lighting money on fire, and that happens. And basically, you have to set up this first. So you have to have the right marketing, but also the right technology to track everything. And we'll get into that in a second. But that's also important as well. Because if you don't have the actual back end, the CRM integrations, the marketing operations, then there's no visibility into actually what you're doing. It doesn't give you a clear understanding of what's going on from point A to point Z. And that's the issue. So that's where a lot of things, I've done this for 8 years now, and I've worked with over 500 plus contractors, and I've talked to thousands of contractors, and I've come to that realization is that it's that lack of that, what I just said, to understanding the actual plan and strategy behind it. Because, you know, honestly, like local service marketing is not super complicated. It is not the hardest thing in the world. It's getting more competitive because of private equity. It's getting more expensive because there's more advertisers, right? There's more people spending money. There's more competition.
And they're all bidding higher.
Yes. So it's getting harder. But in terms of like point A to point Z, it's very, very easy, actually. Compared to other industries, it's a lot more complicated, right? So that is like the issue. So yeah, man, I want to get into actual, you just mentioned earlier, like you invested a full training facility. How did that happen? Like it's not many people in the trades actually do that. It's important for education, like onboarding, all that stuff. How did you get into that?
Well, it became a necessity. Like it was almost everything that we've done has been like an evolution out of necessity, right? Like we're pretty progressive in looking ahead sometimes, but sometimes it's more reactive, which we're trying to get away from more and more every year. But in that particular instance, we built that in that second year, right? Because we saw we needed somewhere to train. In Ohio, we don't just have gas furnaces. We don't just have air conditioners. Like, we got it all, man. We got heat pumps. We got propane. We got fuel oil. We got boilers, steam boilers, water boilers. Like, you name it, we've got it. Every heating source imaginable. So mini splits are a huge thing right now, right? So heat pumps have become, you know, a huge demand thing right now as the government rebates and stuff have pushed those. So it became a thing where, like, hey, if we're going to hire people from outside the industry, one, we have to be able to show them how we plan to train them. Because if we're going to recruit top tier talent, you can't say like, come work for me. Great. What's your training plan? I don't know your industry. And then point to a furnace in a corner and be like, I'm going to bring you in every day and train you on that furnace right there. That usually is the same one that heats the office, right? Like, it became apparent to us, like, you can't recruit top tier talent. That's not impressive enough. Usually, like, if they're really good at what they do and they're pretty smart individuals, they're not going to come work for a company whose training programs involves one furnace in the corner. So that was kind of the motivation. Like, and then as we tried to fix our own problems too, like, we needed somewhere to work. So we worked with some different distributors and said, like, hey, this is what we're doing. We're going to start hosting quite a few trainings. We'd like to invite you guys to come help put some of those trainings on, since you're very knowledgeable on these products and work with manufacturers. And almost all the equipment was co-opted or donated just straight up. And then it became a thing where once the first few distributors got some equipment in there, like, other distributors started hearing about it, and they'd call us up and be like, can I send you a fully modulating unit? Can I send you a mini split on a stand? Would you be willing to display that and train on it? And we were like, yeah, of course, as long as you guys are willing to come teach us, right? And then all of a sudden, the different manufacturers of, you know, thermostats started reaching out, like, hey, what if you had a thermostat wall? We'll donate our biggest and best ones. And it just grew and grew. And then we had some national trainers come in and do some different trainings at that facility. So kind of the popularity of it grew. And from there, we were able to pretty much have the equipment necessary to conduct any type of training at our facility. So now some distributors even use it for their trainings because it's a nicer facility than the one that they would have to build out, right? So we have, I don't know, probably 30 pieces of operational equipment there. We probably have 40 furnaces with different types of heat exchangers in them so that we can train through heat exchanger experts. We offer a class there pretty regularly where they come to town and use our systems to show people how to inspect those and how to find the failure points on different manufacturers and brands and makes and models. So, but it's awesome. It's got a 25-foot projection, high-definition projection screen. So we can train, like when we're training, it's right there. We actually put a video system on it one time. We were playing like MLB The Show or something. We're not video gamers, but the players were like 8 feet, 10 feet tall. So it was super cool. But again, like we wanted something that was twofold. Like it served its purpose of being an educational facility, something that attracted our current talent and team members to wanting to be engaged and want to go there and train. So we needed it to be appealing to them, but we also needed to be able to use it as a recruiting tool so that we could recruit competition that already was in the industry and then also prospective people from outside the industry. So that when we went, like we've hired multiple technicians from Xerox Corporation, my past industry, right? When I bring a Xerox guy in, like Xerox's offices are nice. They're very technology driven. So if I'm walking you into an office that feels like an old trades office and I don't have a great training facility, you're not going to be willing to make that plunge. So we pride ourselves, like all of our offices kind of have the same look, like they're very technology driven. This is just one of our many conference rooms, our training facility. When you walk in, you get that same vibe. So almost always the reaction, whether you're a competitor coming there to train, which we do train our competition, even in our local markets, whether you're a prospective employee, whether you're someone like with Walsh University who's from outside the industry or Lieutenant Governor John Husted, the reaction is always the same. They're like, holy cow, this is different. This feels different. This doesn't feel like an HVAC company. This doesn't look like an HVAC company. You guys are kind of a technology company. And Chad and I usually just kind of like give each other a wink, like mission accomplished. We're doing exactly what we had planned to do. But it was bred out of necessity and grew into much more, to give you the short answer, Mauricio.
And you're solving one of the biggest problems, which is supply, right? The supply side of the business. Because demand is, you that's by marketing, by referrals, all that stuff. But you're, if you have a lot of demand but you can't supply it, then you're kind of screwed, right?
We've had no labor issues over the last 5 years, which is insane. To go with our level of growth, that's the number one thing we hear when we go to conferences and we talk to other business owners. They'll say like, but how have you guys continued to grow despite the labor shortages? And we're like, what labor shortage? Like, I got a bullpen right now, Mauricio, of the next 10 people I'm going to hire, or at least the next 10 people I'm going to try to hire. But it's not going to be through Indeed. It's not going to be through Facebook posts. I already know who they are. You know, I make a habit of when we do a lot of business lunches, right? The nature of being an HVAC business owner, we do a lot of business lunches. Like I go to those restaurants and I sit in those people's sections so I can interact with them and I make jokes with them and I get to know them a little bit. And at some point you pull that string, you go there and say like, hey, just out of curiosity, like what are your plans for your career? And usually if you think about like someone who works at a restaurant, it's a great profession, right? And usually they can make really good money if they're good at it. But most of the time, that's not what they want to do the rest of their life, right? So it feeds into a conversation well, where when they say like, I don't know, like this is good money for now and it's helping me to work my way through college, or, you know, it's a gig that I got right out of college while I wait to figure out what I want to do next. Like if I can bring them to my training facility and I can show them a career path and I can show them a job description, and the day I'm ready to make the offer, I can show them a formal job offer letter that specifies their PTO and their benefits package and their retirement programs and their health insurance and everything, then I feel a lot different than most trades companies, right? All of a sudden they're like, again, the same way that, you know, people feel when they come to our training facility, like, whoa, you guys are kind of technology. Like I want them to see like, we're a very professional organization, but if I'm scribbling down an offer letter on a napkin and it doesn't include anything about your PTO and your retirement program, and I don't have those programs built out and I don't have a career path for you where I can take you to a wall and say like, you'll hire here as a level one tech today, but I believe strongly that with 6 months of the right training, I can get you to a level two. And then that comes with this pay raise, and then a level three, and then a level four. And I can project out the next 10 years for you here. Like now I'm starting to give them a vision, and a vision is something that people invest in. People just don't want jobs these days. They want careers. They want to be a part of something. And I think the cool thing is like, that's what we want. So I don't understand this like labor shortage thing. Like we want what they want. We want you to come here and work forever. The last thing I want to do is invest in you and train you and make you a part of my team and my family only for you to leave me in 3 years, right? Like that's what I want. And when we talk to contractors across the country, they say the same thing. Yeah, they're not willing to do what's required to keep those people part of their family because they see them as too expensive. And I sat in a training years and years ago, and I swear he's the one that said it first. I've heard a million people say it since, but I had a very wise leader. His name was Gordy Opitz early on. We were in this big Xerox training. This is this is probably 15, 20 years ago now, and somebody was talking about training. You have to invest in your talent. And this was, again, at Xerox. Like, you have to invest. And there's 150 people in the room, very smart business leaders. And somebody raised their hand. And they asked the guy who was directing this symposium, and he said, like, but what do you do when you invest all this money and effort and energy into these teams, and then they leave? And the guy just kind of sat there thinking about it for a second. And the guy who I was kind of mentored under, he raised his hand. He's like, can I ask another question? What happens if you don't invest in them and they stay? And like, that was my moment where I realized, like, oh, dang, Gordy's the sharpest tool in the shed. So I definitely need to hang on his every word. But two, like, man, he's right. Like, think about that. If you're so afraid to invest in your people because you might make them so good that they leave, like, you got an organizational issue. That's on me. It's on my, we've had people leave. We've also had people leave and come back, right? But we always say, like, it's, we'll never hold you back. If you feel you can get something out in the market that you can't get from us, then shame on us, right? We, maybe organization, we're just not at the size yet that we can offer you that, or we don't have that position available. But if there was an opportunity to keep you here and keep you happy and we failed to see it because we didn't communicate well or we didn't adapt quick enough, then that's on us. And we need to do some introspection and make sure that we don't make that same mistake over and over again. But it goes back to the first thing we talked about, Mauricio, like this vulnerability and inspecting everything and saying, like, I'm not perfect, right? Like, where do we screw up and how do we retain you? But we've had so low turnover and virtually no issues hiring people. If we target someone, I would say we get 9 out of 10 people that we go after, because we're able to paint that clear vision for them. They come in here and they're like, this feels good. I see it. Like, I could work here forever. And again, we're not perfect. We tell them that too. Like, but we need you. We need you to come in. And we always tell our new hires this, like, you come in with this really unique perspective for like the first 90 days, and then you start to develop a little bit of tunnel vision. So for the first 90 days, we need you to be very transparent with us. You're going to have this ability to see things from a fresh perspective that we can't see things from anymore. We just can't. It's impossible, right? It's like the daddy goggles. Like, your kid might suck at baseball, but you just can't see it because he's your kid and you love him to death. This is our business. We love it to death. We might not be able to see something, but you can for 90 days. Like, please be transparent with us. Please tell us if you see something that stands out to you. And they will. And then you got to be willing to hear it and say, like, you know, now you got somebody new on board who's criticizing your baby. So you got to make a choice. Do I have this mentality of like, who the hell are you to tell me what's wrong with my business? You've barely been here long enough to fog up a mirror, right? Like, that's one mentality. That's the one that leads to a lack of process and progress. The second mentality is like, oh, maybe you're onto something there. Like, you've only been here for a few weeks and you see this issue. Like, maybe I should pick at that a little bit. Maybe I should see if there's something to that, right? And then inevitably, the question I always ask them is, if they say like, hey, you asked me for feedback, like, this is something I've noticed, I always want to know their perspective on how to fix it. So I usually say like, ah, that's interesting. Like, you might be onto something. Like, how would you fix it? Have you thought about that yet? Because I want to take advantage of the fact that they, from their fresh perspective, might also have a fresh perspective on how we can create a process or a way of fixing that issue.
I want to be mindful of your time. I have a few other questions. First one is about AI, right? And you mentioned technology. How are you using AI in your company?
Yeah, I love AI. So I started using AI. I was an early adopter about 3-4 years ago, I think, like, right. And it wasn't that good then, but I didn't lose faith in it. But man, my ChatGPT account, I would pay you, if somebody hacked me today, I'd pay you $1 million for it, because my profiles are so built out. I was always diligent in like building out my different profiles, whether it's me as a dad, me as a guy who's doing a home renovation, me as the business owner, me as the guy who's, you know, on the Dover Youth Baseball Board, whatever it was, so that they're kind of learning me. But now I can have that thing write a job description for me in, you know, 2 seconds flat. And because it's built out this history of like, it already knows what I want culturally, the way I define our roles, who we are, the why. It doesn't just write out a job description. It writes out a job description that is better than anything I could have written, because it is me, but it incorporates everything that human error would have probably forgot as I went to write that job description. So sometimes I'll read these job descriptions and be like, dang, like, that is important to me, but I wouldn't have put that in there because, you know, that was something I haven't talked as much about in a year. So it's just so cool to be able to do things like that. Speed to lead, it's improved that. Like, you know, we can write things in minutes that used to take us days, right? We can write job descriptions in minutes that you put really good data in and it spits out really, really good data. You're constantly feeding and developing it. So just from a speed and versatility standpoint, it's added a lot. We incorporated some AI intelligence in the way we answer our phones. You know, organizationally, like, we prided ourselves in always being a company to answer with a live person. Back to what I said earlier, like, here we are, a company that focuses on our coworkers, but we want to be answering the phones 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Like, yeah, hey, skip Christmas with your family because we got to answer the phones first. Like, it doesn't really, sometimes that seems hypocritical, you know, the two don't support each other. So if we really want to show that we are a great place to work and we do care a lot about our coworkers, we need them to take Christmas off. But we also need our customers' phones to get answered, right? Because we do still have to work and serve their needs. We live in a state where like it's 0 degrees right now and we'll be for the next week. So we can't just not answer our phones because our coworkers have events. So we've leveraged that to support and backfill with AI to answer the phones. And I'll be the first to tell you, like, I don't love that. I want it to always be people, but you know, I'm doing it in the spirit of supporting people, just my coworkers. And if my customers can still get their phones answered in a pretty good way and still get it booked accurately and still get the call entered so we can dispatch a technician and get your heat fixed. Like, what we found is our customers have been pretty receptive to it. There have been a couple of instances where I had to explain the why, and I'm the one that does that as the owner. I reach out, and I had to talk to a lady a few weeks ago. She's, you'll like this, Mauricio. She says, I want to know what idiot in your company decided it would be a smart decision to use AI to answer your phones. And she had called on New Year's Eve at like 10:30 p.m., right? And I said, well, ma'am, you're actually talking to the idiot. And she's like, oh, well, and she kind of started backpedaling. I said, no, please don't backpedal, because you hit the nail on the head. Like, I was very reluctant to make that decision. And but can I take a second and explain to you why, again, back to the why, we made that decision organizationally to do that? She's like, it won't make sense, but yeah, go ahead, give it a try. So I said, sure. I said, you know what kind of company we are in this community. Like, we pride ourselves in being a huge supporter of civic events, and baseball teams and sports teams and schools and just everything, right? The local community, 501c3s, like, that's who we are. And so we, you know, think like, hey, anything we could do to better serve our customers is always going to be the top priority. But sometimes that directly conflicts with what's best with our support staff, right? And so I explained it to her the same way I explained it to you a minute ago. Like, it helps us to make sure that when we have trainings that all of us, CSRs, can be included, we don't have to leave someone out. We can roll phones to AI for an hour so that we can benefit long term from all of them getting that same training together. It allows us to give them holidays off. Like, and I explained to her, and this is the way we function, like, they always have first dibs on any overtime, any extra shifts, any of the bad shifts. Like, I even tried hiring someone that only wanted to work the bad shifts for a while. And about 2 months in, they got bored with only working bad shifts and they quit, right? So we use it to supplement so that we can continue to support our customers. When I finished, she was like, wow, like, that actually does make a lot of sense. I'm glad you took the time to explain that to me, right? So, but yeah, it's not perfect, but I think it's necessary. The way that we can support the front end process of, like, you've seen Field Pro, I'm sure, or Sales Pro, now they're calling it, in Service Titan. Like, you can sit there and listen to a technician on a call for 2 hours and still miss things, or you can get an AI summary in 2 seconds that's gonna, you know, look at how you hit your benchmarks on that service call. Did you ask the customer where to park? Did you talk to them about a maintenance program? Did you talk to them about financing options? Did you present them well? Like, it'll talk about tone, inflection, you know, when the customer says this, you should say this, eliminate negative keywords that could lead to a negative interaction. Like, it can give you a beautiful summary in 2 seconds, like literally 2 seconds, that you can review in 5 minutes and become a better technician, a better comfort advisor. Like, why would you ever want to have to pay someone to sit there and review that data for 2 hours to only get an imperfect result from it, right? When you can get a darn near perfect result in less than 2 minutes. So, you know, it didn't require that we eliminate jobs when we use Field Pro. What it did is probably prevented us from someone having to hire someone to do that, and also added a level of consistency that people, you know, aren't always able to bring to the table. Where we can quickly give our technicians feedback that they need and want to grow. So I think just leveraging AI and technology in a way that you can't look at it as like, how's it going to replace things with my business always, but how can it enhance them? How can I use it to supplement it to make us more agile and quicker to market and just better all around, right? Maybe it prevents me from having to hire as many people moving forward. But I will say we haven't replaced one person with AI, and we have no intentions of doing that. But I do think we'll be able to grow faster by leveraging AI. And I think we'll be able to be more nimble and more efficient by leveraging AI.
Yeah, yeah. You guys, correct me if I'm wrong, had an exit last year, right?
No exit here, man. I'm still sitting in the business, but we did partner with Sela. Yeah, so I invested heavily back in, Chad and I did. Both will have increased roles within the big Sela platform now. So that was cool that they thought enough of us as operators that they're now trying to kind of spread us across more of their core companies, which is awesome. It's kind of what I did at Xerox Corporation is we started acquiring a lot of companies. So I'm very familiar with this. I've been through it before. So very comfortable with it. But yeah, I went through a pretty extreme vetting process for almost a year. I didn't go into it like, which is the right company. It was very much a process of like, is this right for us organizationally? But looking at, you know, what it was able to do for our coworkers from a, you know, like a health insurance premium standpoint, it just made sense. Equipment costs so that we can be competitive in our marketplace and better support our customers without some obscene prices. You know, I don't love what we have to charge these days, but it is what it is. I mean, that's the market, right? So how do we make sure that we can be competitive for years to come and give our customers the best pricing available? And Sela has some great pricing out there with some distributors, same distributors we were working with before, by the way. So we just got better pricing overnight, better top line support. You know, we were at a pivotal point in that $30 million range where we were going to have to build out, you know, an HR team, hire a dedicated CFO. And so, but what we got access to overnight was like their finance team and their accounting team and a CFO and some pretty good HR folks and Mary Ellen and some resources there. So I'll just tell you, like, as we went more and more into the process and looked more and more at the different companies, that one just seemed like a natural fit for us. Very much a people-focused organization. Now they're obviously backed by Goldman Sachs now, so there's some metrics and some accountability, but I like that. I'm a carrot guy. Like, you give me a nut and I'll go chase it. So that's kind of exciting for me, that it's not just Chad and I always having to establish the standard and where the hurdle is. Like, now someone else is getting to set that for us and we get to just be more chasers. So I actually like that, and I think Chad's already enjoying it just a few months in. But yeah, I'm excited, man. The Sela family is a phenomenal family. I'm so impressed with some of the operators in our own, right outside of our own market, that I'm like, man, you guys are smart. You're sharp. And they're so much more willing to share now because we're in the same family and we all are tied to some performance incentive, right, that is driven by each other doing well, which I don't think that's the only reason we share so well. I think it's also just this natural fit where everyone wants to see each other do well. But it's cool to not just be on an island going at it on your own, and to have some pretty awesome resources. Love the new boss man, Jody. He's a fantastic fit. We actually had a mutual connection, that Gordy that I told you about a minute ago, that said that in that meeting. Turns out he was a really good friend of his, and they're from the Buffalo area. And what are the chances of him and I having this mutual connection? We walked in, he's like, wait, you said Gordy, like, it wouldn't be Gordy Opitz, would it? I'm like, this is the first time we met. I'm like, yeah, Gordy Opitz. You know Gordy? He's like, from Buffalo? Yeah. Scratch golfer? I'm like, yeah. He's like, yeah. He's been one of my good friends for many years. I'm like, holy crap. Like, this is a big world. And somehow we had this really cool, unique connection. So, but yeah, I'm excited to see what the future holds. I'm glad we got the weight of Sela pushing us. I think some companies might not like that, but Chad and I like somebody that's constantly behind us cracking the whip a little bit. I think it makes us run a little faster. So I think it's going to be a great fit.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. You have a podcast coming out, right?
I do. You're going to give me a chance to drop it here, Mauricio? So it's called One Tough Day. So you can find it on Facebook. It'll be on Spotify. It'll be in the Apple Podcast Studio. So One Tough Day. We got some awesome guest lists lined up. Brigham is on there, and a great mentor to me, Pete Battisti. He was actually a president of sales for Xerox Corporation. So this dude is unbelievable. The knowledge he's going to drop when it comes to leadership and how to build your teams out. I would not be where I am today without Pete Battisti. Just an incredible leader. Of course, episode one's me and Chad. Got to know Chad's story. But the spirit behind it, real quick, Mauricio, is this. Like, there's so many podcasts dedicated to, you know, pounding the chest and fist pumping. You know that as well as I do. And I appreciate kind of that your podcast is a little different too. So that's great. But I think people have heard enough of that. I think people want to know the tough day stories. I know for me, as I've grown in business over the last 25 years in leadership, from, you know, vice president of sales at a Fortune 500 company to now business owner, partner of a Fortune 500 type company, I think the stories that have influenced me the most are not the stories that came on the best days. It's the stories that came on a tough day. And those are the defining moments of business. The day where you were drowning, man. You were flailing in the water and you didn't know how much longer you could go. And usually they define who you are organizationally. They define the way that you approach life and business moving forward. And I just have always found those as the most compelling stories. So I was having dinner last year at Pantheon with a business partner, actually Zach Deering, the owner of Mantle, co-owner of Mantle. And we were talking about that and how he was attracted to the same thing. He's like, that's the podcast, man. And people have been pushing me to do a podcast for a while, but I'm the type of guy, like, I'm not getting a tattoo until I know exactly what I want. I don't just walk in and do the gumball thing, right? So I just wanted to have meaning behind our podcast. And Zach's like, that's it, man. What if you would have these different influencers, business leaders, entrepreneurs on the show and talk about, you know, all the great things, but also at some point ask them, like, tell me about the toughest day and how it defined you and changed who you were. And I'm like, that's brilliant. That's it. So it was kind of like a New Year's resolution this year. Some people are holding me accountable to get this thing off the ground. So we've already recorded quite a few episodes. We got quite a few more to record, but it drops next week. Next week, I think it's January 27th, I want to say, is the launch date. but you can find it at One Tough Day on Facebook. It's got like little blue band-aids over it. So look for us there, and I would love to engage your audience that you built out and see if we can offer them a little bit more help. And people are always, you know, able to find me online. They can hit me at steve@anyofourcompanies.com. So steve@bonskyheating.com, steve@simpsonsalute.com. Look me up on LinkedIn, whatever they want to do. But I think you'll find I'll always respond, man. I love helping people. And again, it's giver's gain. I'm going to help you, and I'm sure at some point you'll be able to help me. So I'm very excited to be able to engage more people through this podcast.
Awesome. Steve, I'm excited to see that podcast once it comes out. I'll send you the link, and then we can chat more about that. I really appreciate that. Steve, man, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mauricio. Best wishes to you in 2026, man. I hope you crush all your personal goals as well.
You too, man.
Thanks for listening to AI and Marketing for Home Service Pros. If you got value from today's episode, do us a favor. Follow the show, share it with a contractor friend, and leave a quick review. Want help using AI or smarter marketing to grow your business? Head to contractormarketingpros.net and book your free strategy call.